You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we'll talk to an artist from Milwaukee about his new exhibit of paintings that use water from rivers and lakes with a connection to black history. Now, over the last month, at least six states have signed into law bills adding new abortion restrictions. Not all of them have gone into immediate effect, with some legal challenges pending. But it continues a trend that started with controversial laws in Mississippi and Texas that served as the framework for the states that followed. The U.S. Supreme Court is expected to rule this summer on the Mississippi law that bans most abortions after 15 weeks. That ruling could shape how Roe v. Wade is interpreted and set the precedent for other states passing similar laws. We're catching up on recent legislation and checking in on the status of abortion access in the United States. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. What questions do you have about new abortion laws in other states? Do you think states should be able to regulate abortions at the state level, or should it be a federal decision? Do you want the Supreme Court to decide? What do you want them to decide? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. Michelle Oberman is the Catherine and George Alexander Professor of Law at Santa Clara University. She's the author of the book Her Body, Our Laws, on the front lines of the abortion war from El Salvador to Oklahoma. Michelle, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for inviting me.
Before we get into some of the specific laws and specific states, why are we seeing so many states tackle this issue right now?
Well, I think that's part of a long-term strategy that anti-abortion advocates have really been elaborating over the course of the past 50 years. And all of it is coming to a head now that there are five or perhaps even six reliable conservative votes on the Supreme Court. So there's a sense that these laws that historically have been passed we'll call them red states, but not allowed to go into effect, might actually be allowed to go into effect if the court decides, as it's expected to do, that it's going to return the right to control abortion laws to the states.
Let's look at that case in the Supreme Court now, the one you just referenced, Dobbs versus Jackson Women's Health Organization, challenging the constitutionality of Mississippi's 15-week abortion ban. What is the court weighing in that decision? What is the range of decisions that they could make from, I guess, getting rid of Roe versus Wade altogether or a more narrow ruling?
Yeah. So actually, since 1992, the standard for state laws that would restrict abortion is that states are required to keep abortion legal. And aren't allowed to pass laws that would place what's called an undue burden on a woman's ability to access abortion. And so historically, for example, we've seen laws that allow up to a 72-hour waiting period between the first request for an abortion and the actual procedure. We've seen laws that effectively restrict access by requiring doctors to have certain credentials or clinics to have certain credentials. We've seen laws around informed consent, all found to be constitutional because they don't put that heavy burden, the undue burden, on a woman's right to access abortion. The Mississippi law is noteworthy because it moves access back to a 15-week cutoff point, something that seemed pretty radical and at the time that it was passed, because it's a point that everybody agrees is prior to viability. But it's also a point at which most people know that they're pregnant, right? You've passed the first trimester, you've missed almost three periods. And so the thought is that certainly by 15 weeks, a person would know that they were pregnant. Of course, the vast majority of abortions occur in the first trimester, over 90%. The abortions that tend to occur later at 15 weeks or later tend to involve either fatal fetal anomalies or a mother whose life or health is at risk. So somebody who, say, discovers midway through a pregnancy that they have cancer, and in order to treat it, we are advised to terminate the pregnancy, right? So the Supreme Court, in looking at that Mississippi law, has three choices. The first is to say that it places an undue burden on the woman's health, right, or the woman's right to access abortion. The second would be to say it actually doesn't, right? That we could live with a 15-week ban because most people realize they're pregnant before then and can take actions. And then the third would be to say, actually, we're dispensing with the undue burden standard. We're overturning Roe versus Wade, and we're allowing states to decide whether or not to make abortion criminal. Right? And those who are watching, sort of the court watchers who are watching carefully, are of the mind that the Supreme Court seems likely to go with the third option, to say, you know what, fetuses have rights too, and we're going to return this whole issue to the states and let them decide when and whether to restrict abortion access.
We are talking about abortion laws, abortion restrictions passing in many states around the country. Michelle Oberman is with us, professor of law at Santa Clara University. You could join in with your questions about the kind of laws being passed, what you would like to see in place, whether you think Roe versus Wade should stay in place or if the Supreme Court should overturn it and throw things to the states. Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. Michelle, are we seeing stricter standards coming up in states than that 15-week timeline?
Absolutely. There's a there's really an exuberance to the anti-abortion forces at state legislative levels around the country. We're seeing laws passed that would make it a felony punishable by a decade in prison to perform an abortion. We're seeing a lot of so-called 6-week or heartbeat abortion bans. We're seeing statutes that make it a felony to aid and assist a person seeking an abortion. So the Mississippi law is just sort of one of countless laws that are being floated or passed. Or passed and enacted with an eye to what the law in the state will be if and when the U.S. Supreme Court decides to overturn the standard of Roe and Casey.
We're seeing some states pass a trigger ban, so-called Wyoming, the latest one, saying we have this ban. It's not in effect. We're not going to try to bring it into effect unless and until Roe versus Wade is overturned. Also, some states like Wisconsin have laws that never were overturned, technically, that might, and this is an argument here in the state, might come back into effect if Roe versus Wade is overturned. Can you talk about that trigger law approach?
Yeah, there's a number of states in the country that, in anticipation of Roe versus Wade someday falling, have had for a while laws on the books that will spring into effect as soon as Roe is struck down. I think it's going to be, from a lawyer's perspective, a really interesting time. There'll be a certain amount of chaos on the ground. What I mean by that is that nobody on either side is quite ready for it. So, for example, imagine that you're a doctor who treats breast cancer, and imagine that your patient has breast cancer and is pregnant, right? So you haven't thought at all about abortion. And for decades, the standard of care has been a certain form of chemotherapy that might be harmful to the fetus. And for decades, the standard of care would be to say, look, it's up to you if you want to end this pregnancy or if you want to postpone treatment. Those doctors are going to suddenly find themselves wondering whether this is in fact a life-threatening pregnancy and therefore qualifies for an exception and it's a legal abortion. They're going to wonder whether in simply advising the patient about her options facing a cancer that is life-threatening, perhaps, whether they can advise her to travel to a state where it's legal, right? I mean, it just the uncertainty around the simple idea of a trigger law is, it's almost overwhelming. I mean, that's a very specific little example, but there are so many other examples that I can call into view if we had hours. So, yes, there will be these trigger laws coming quickly into effect, and there'll be a sense of deep uncertainty at every level in terms of how to understand the risks that you're facing under the law and the options that you have in terms of both responding to other conditions, but also in terms of responding to an unwanted pregnancy.
We're talking to Santa Clara University law professor Michelle Oberman about abortion access, recent laws passed in states around the country, many passing restrictions, some giving more guarantees to abortion access. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Are you in favor of restrictions on access to abortion? What is your dividing line? Where do you draw the line? What do you agree with, not agree with, from what you've heard about some states around the country? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our conversation about new abortion laws around the U.S. A lot of states taking action now. Michelle Oberman stays with us, professor of law at Santa Clara University, author of the book Her Body, Our Laws on the Front Lines of the Abortion War from El Salvador to Oklahoma. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts, your questions. That's 800-642-1234. Let's go to your calls now. Scott is with us in Madison. Scott, hi.
Afternoon. One that I have had in my head is people continue to call a fetus an unborn child. Will that unborn child fall under child safety restraints in automobiles?
Scott, thanks for the call. Michelle, that's Scott getting into the possible unanticipated consequences of changing that definition.
Yeah, what's so interesting about that question, Scott, is that it actually points to a whole area of law that will be relevant if abortion is illegal, and that is, what is the legal status of the fetus, right? Does it become a child with rights as a child? And if so, then what happens to, just say, child abuse and neglect laws? What about a pregnant woman who's doing something that might be seen as potentially risky, eating sushi, having a drink, going for a jog, right? And if she's doing that, then does a person watching her have a duty to call in and report her, right? Does the father of the child suddenly have an obligation or the threat of legal liability for a failure to intervene? I mean, it sounds nutty. It sounds like a crazy law school hypothetical, but it's not, because we haven't yet determined what the scope of legal rights are for the fetus. And I mean, it's just one small example of some of the chaos that I think is to come legally as we sort through the implications of banning abortion. A state doesn't need to. A state could say, actually, fetus doesn't have the same rights as a child, but the woman doesn't have a right to end an unwanted pregnancy. And so I think you'll see states doing a variety of things. In El Salvador, where I did my field work for my book, the first line of the Constitution says a person is a human being from the moment of conception. And so they answer that question about rights literally before the fertilized egg implants in the wall of the uterus. And they just leave for another day questions about voting rights. Like, well, if it's a person, does it have the right to vote? Right. Or taxation rights, and obligations, things like that.
Thanks for that call.
Good question, though.
Thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. Michelle, before we go back to our callers, I know you've written and thought about the impact of abortion restrictions, especially as we get closer to total bans, on women, on low-income women in particular. What kind of things do you watch for there?
Yeah, I'm really glad that you brought that up, because what I study and care most about is not the change in the law on the books, but the impact of the law on the ground. And what we know about abortion is that the biggest demand for abortion, sort of the most common reason people give for needing or wanting an abortion, is that they cannot afford a child. 75% of abortions, literally 3 out of every 4 abortions in this country, go to people who are poor or near poor. And abortion bans won't be colorblind. Right. I mean, abortion's not colorblind. Abortion bans aren't colorblind. Abortion disproportionately impacts the lives of the poorest Americans, who are disproportionately Black and brown. Those poorest folks are the ones who are most likely to struggle with accessing abortion where it's illegal, whether it's by traveling to a state where it is legal, or whether it's by accessing abortion medicines online, which anybody with a debit card and enough education to discern which of the websites are valid would find it very easy to access the drugs needed to end an unwanted pregnancy. But on the ground, access to abortion and the impact of the bans is going to vary according to class. So the biggest takeaway from our ban is not going to be a huge amount of deterrence in terms of abortion. It's going to be an uptick in the number of babies born into poverty. Like the poorest folks among us are going to be those who would have had abortions if it was legal. They're going to be the ones who aren't able to navigate how to get themselves to a place where it remains legal. They're going to have children, and already those families constitute the bulk of child poverty in this country, right? 38% of single mother families live below the poverty line. So abortion bans, you can't really think about them separately from thinking about poverty in this country.
Go back to our callers at 800-642-1234. Angela is with us in Green Bay. Angela, hi.
Hi. I'm so glad you guys mentioned that. I feel like our focus is always on whether or not the fetus is considered human, and it's just this back and forth. I just kind of feel like the focus should be more on the reasons why women have abortions in the first place, and maybe to come up with processes or something to just kind of help to counteract that, whether it's education, whatever it is, just to help with the situation. Because I'm sure it's not like women are going out there and just having abortions willy-nilly. It's a huge decision, and it's something I'm sure a lot of women have to take their time at making that decision. It's something that's not taken lightly.
Angela, yeah. Thanks for the call. Michelle.
I love what you said, your observation, Angela. We've had a really stupid conversation, frankly, about abortion for the past 50 years, one that focuses on whether or not it should be legal, one that doesn't really have a comfortable answer, right? We're not agreeing on it. We haven't agreed for 50 years. We're not likely to agree. And we haven't asked, well, what do you do if you want people to have fewer abortions, right? And the answer then is actually pretty simple. I mean, we know from everything around the world and in this country that the biggest thing that we can do to deter abortion is to actually increase access to contraception, right? I mean, half of all unintended pregnancies end in abortion. When people have access to contraception, they have fewer abortions, right? But even if we're not able to get to agreement around that, I really believe that there are, you know, sort of people of goodwill on both sides of this abortion war who want to actually support poor people who would have their babies if they could afford them. And once we start to focus on what drives abortion, I think we start to see really clearly the situations that I think, you know, that are endemic in this country, right? The expectations that childbearing is a private choice and that children are private choices, not public goods. In countries with the lowest abortion rates around the world, what you see is subsidized daycare. You see guaranteed paid parental leave. You see tax subsidies. You see child allowances. You see excellent public school available locally in your neighborhood, right? And all of these things require a country that actually wants to encourage people to have babies. We don't live in that country, right? I mean, this is not a country that wants to encourage poor people to have kids. We don't like abortion, maybe, but we also don't like poor people having babies, apparently.
Thanks for that call. Time for one more caller. Rob is with us in Wisconsin Dells. Rob, hi.
Hi there. Just want to give you a backstory on myself. I, when I was 18, had an abortion. I also had worked in the OB as I got older, and I currently have two children of my own. If I wasn't allowed legal access to abortion when I was that young, I wouldn't be here. So just remember that.
Thanks for that call, Rob. Michelle, I think a lot of people with stories like that not always heard.
Yeah, thank you so much for the courage to share your story. I mean, I think we're moving into an era in which more of us will need that level of courage. We have to talk about the circumstances that surround these really difficult decisions because it's the only way forward.
Thanks again for calling in and sharing that. Michelle, in just our last minute and a half or so, what are you, obviously the U.S. Supreme Court decision, what are you watching for next as states continue to pursue various kinds of restrictions?
What I'm watching for is whether there's going to be a schism between people who are pro-life, meaning they really want babies to be born, and people who are anti-abortion, meaning they just want the laws to make abortion illegal, right? And that distinction hasn't mattered up until now because it was all legal anyways. But I think there's going to be a split. I think that folks who have supported abortion bans because they thought abortion would go away when it was banned are going to be deeply disappointed when they see that it actually continues, and that that schism might lead to a realignment where we can actually start to see policies that support the poorest and most vulnerable among us.
As you were saying earlier, you think that our debate has been stupid in many ways. Do you see it getting smarter in any way in the next, I don't know, 5 years?
Yeah, I mean, I guess I'm an eternal optimist that way. And I think putting a face, just like Robin did and just like Angela did just now, I mean, putting a face on the decisions that surround how people respond to an unwanted or an unplanned pregnancy, putting faces on that will really call upon us to have conversations about what we owe to folks who are affected by abortion bans and what we owe to folks who are facing an unwanted pregnancy that's unwanted because they can't afford a child, right? I mean, 60% of abortions go to people who already have children. So, I mean, I'm hopeful that we'll start to see a new alignment around a sense of moral obligation toward the most vulnerable among us.
Michelle, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us.
My pleasure. Thanks to you.
Michelle Oberman is the Catherine and George Alexander Professor of Law at Santa Clara University. She's the author of the book Her Body, Our Laws on the Front Lines of the Abortion War from El Salvador to Oklahoma. She was with us today talking about the status of abortion access in the wake of new laws passed by several states across the country and a Supreme Court case in the works. Stay on top of the biggest issues facing Wisconsin and beyond every weekday on The Morning Show with Kate Archer-Kent. Tomorrow, we'll look at book bans around the country in libraries and schools. That's tomorrow morning here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. Coming up, we'll learn about Color in the Outdoors, a Wisconsin organization that's encouraging marginalized groups to get outside and enjoy outdoor activities. Now, there's a new exhibit coming to the Museum of Wisconsin Art, Mirroring Reflection, features paintings by Kahari Turner, originally from Milwaukee. Turner says he wants his work to celebrate his ancestors. Part of the way he does that is by using water from lakes, rivers, and oceans that have a connection to Black history. Kahari Turner joins us now. His new exhibit opens at the Museum of Wisconsin Art in West Bend on the last Saturday of April. Kahari, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Well, take us through what this exhibit will look like if we show up on opening day on the 30th.
Oh, it'll honestly, it's really interesting. So there's a lot of different colors. There's a lot of different kind of ways to explore the work. But essentially what you'll see is a lot of different figurative and then non-figurative or abstract kind of mixing of painting and water and ocean water and the things that I use in all of my work kind of put together in a way, kind of like a family portrait or a family reunion of sorts in a painting style.
And who's that family?
It's kind of all over the place. The way that I think about my work is more of like a abstract person as well, like a ancestral, but then maybe universal type figure. So essentially it could be anybody, and it could maybe be somebody you know, or it could be your next door neighbor. But the point is that, you know, you connect to the person as a body of water to another body of water, which is the painting. Like, everybody's made up of water, so we should all connect through water in one way or another.
Yeah, can you talk about the element of water in your work? On a practical side, you're going out to lakes and rivers and oceans and collecting the water that's going to end up in your paint?
Yeah, exactly. So I'll go out to different places, including like Lake Michigan, which is one of the Great Lakes, and it's right next to my home. And then think about the connection to me and me just being a person, and what does it mean to have Lake Michigan and Lake Michigan water run through me as a person? Like, I drink water that's, you know, sourced through Lake Michigan, as well as, you know, we drink water from all over these places. And so that connection to water is really just one of those things that it unifies everybody, because, you know, one way or another, everybody's a part of this water, especially the Great Lakes. There's so much water that people drink that are coming from those areas, as well as all of the rivers that flow throughout the United States. And so I just go to those locations, kind of get a giant gallon of water, dip it into the water in one area or another, and take it back to my studio.
Does a painting have, I don't know, like a different personality if it came from a river or a Great Lake or an ocean or this river versus that river?
It's a little bit of a mix. So the way I do it is because of the salt in the ocean water and the ink that I use, the ink kind of floats on top of the ocean water. And then as it floats, the water will kind of move it however it wants to. And then what I'll do is I'll add fresh water from the lakes and rivers to kind of go in and push some of those things, push some of the ink out of the way. And so you kind of see in the work where the history of the water flowed on the painting. And as the painting dries, all of the ink stops and pretty much lets you know a whole story of what happened with the water, how the water influenced the work, and then how the water kind of finished off.
I read, I think it was in one of your statements, you want to celebrate your ancestors in your paintings. Mm-hmm. Can you tell us more about that part of your work?
Yeah, so one thing is, as a African-American or Black person in the United States, and being also a person who does not, you know his father, there's a lot of different things as far as like my own history that I don't know. And so in doing so, the people that I paint are that kind of that idea. Like, I know that they'll have some of the features that I'm painting, but they essentially could be anybody. And the point of the work is to be able to grab as many ideas of different people as possible and put them in a painting, so then it's really easy to not, you know, get stuck on, okay, maybe they look like this or maybe they look like this, but wait, they could look like anything, and the ability to look like anything is powerful. At least I hope so.
I wanted to ask about just kind of where the concept came from with the water and tying it into that ancestry and the history. Was this just like an epiphany that hit you all of a sudden, or just something you gradually developed? Like, I'm really curious about how that came about.
Yeah, it was kind of an epiphany on a weird scale. I was thinking about kind of abstraction and like figuration, or just like real versus not real, for a long time. And being from Milwaukee, the Great Lakes were right there. I spent a lot of time by water. And so I started thinking, like, what type of history do I have with water? And then what type of history would I want to talk about with water? And obviously I could talk about all the different things that happened, all the boats that came to the United States, anything that happened in water, I could talk about, you know. And so I thought about that for a long time. But then during quarantine, that kind of first couple months, I ended up taking a trip out to California, and I was right next to the Pacific Ocean. And I was, you know, I've been thinking about water this whole time during quarantine. I was like, well, you know, I'm right over here. Let me put some water in a painting and just see what happens, you know, conceptually thinking about art in general. And when I put it in, I realized that it turned the medium, or it made the paint change. And once I saw that, I was like, oh, I gotta explore this way more. And so then it just happened.
I understand you hope to have an organization someday that gives back to young artists, people who are where you used to be. Could you say a little more about that?
Yeah, so I've been thinking about this a lot, actually. There's a lot of different ways that I want to do it. Right now I'm looking into, like, hopefully within the next 5 years at least, to maybe build or work on creating community centers. There's a lot of different things that I felt like were really great for me growing up that I don't see anymore in the community. And I feel like those type of places where people can go and, you know, be able to get resources and whatnot is very important. So I'm like thinking about a lot of different ways to give back in one way or another, also doing ocean cleanups and then also teaching classes for youth, and hoping that, you know, maybe my experience of coming from where I came from and, you know, making it how I'm making it right now will be inspiring in one way or another. Or at least helpful, for sure.
Can you give a shout out to something in Milwaukee in your youth that helped inspire you?
Yeah, there's a bunch of different places. Definitely a YMCA. I never mentioned that, but I was at the YMCA in Milwaukee. Lake Valley Camp, which is now Peak, is amazing. I went there for 13 odd years. So Lake Valley Camp, which is now Peak, shout out to them. They do amazing work in the community as well as work with so many children. And then I think that's it. I also took like classes at Brown Deer High School. So Brown Deer High School, they're out there. I took like swim lessons there when I first when I was really young.
The water
and then
and
I
the
actually
art.
Went to, yeah, yeah. And then I went to high school there. So it was great.
Kahari, thanks so much for sharing this with us today.
Thank you for having me.
That's artist Kahari Turner, originally from Milwaukee, talking to us about his upcoming exhibit. It's called Mirroring Reflection. It opens at the Museum of Wisconsin Art in West Bend on April 30th. It's going to run through early July. Right now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with an answer to an audience question about a historic football team.
Gene Jansen wrote to Wisconsin about the Little Chute Flying Dutchman, a semi-pro football team that played for three decades, a mere 25 miles from Lambeau Field. He remembered the team from his youth and hoped to learn more about its history. With his help, WPR's Jenny Peake hit the archives to learn more.
When Gene Jansen was a boy, he spent many Sunday mornings helping ready the field for the Little Chute Flying Dutchman, his town's very own semi-pro football team.
We'd go to the lumber yard, and that's where we'd get the line and at this machine and put the lines up. And all the yard markers had to be 17 and a half inches in from the sidelines, you know. And it took a long time because you had 50 yards one way and 50 yards going the other way.
That was in the late 1940s, but the team got its start in 1920. Over the years, the Flying Dutchman played teams across central and northeast Wisconsin. And while the Dutchmen were able to suit up as a team for 30 straight years, other teams came and went.
After the war, there was other teams that had not have a team because of the war, took a lot of their players away. Fortunately, in Little Chute, we were able to keep going because the St. John's High School was giving teams that the players could keep playing. And so a lot of those players went on to play for the Flying Dutchman.
So what were some of the teams the Flying Dutchman played?
The main four teams was Manitowoc Gales, the Two Rivers Ramblers, and Little Chute, and the Merrill Foxes. I think it was, believe, in 1938. Later on was the New London Edisons, the Clintonville four-wheeler drive truckers, and the Appleton Reds.
But the Dutchmen didn't just play semi-pro teams. Legend has it they also played the Green Bay Packers.
I was able to trace it to 1920. By talking to some of the guys, I heard it was 52-0 that Little Chute got whomped. However, when you read more, it shows where one of the teams actually beat the Packers. I think it was the 1935, you know, like an exhibition game or something like that. The only one of a semi-pro team that ever beat the Packers.
Jansen says fans of the Little Chute Flying Dutchman even tailgated like the Cheeseheads of today.
When they played ball at halftime, where did some of the crowd go at halftime? Where the heck are those guys going? Well, here they're going across the road about a block away, and this guy had a garage, and he had beer in that garage at coolers. And those guys would go over there and get a can of beer, you know. And he had his whole garage lined up with all different kinds of beer cans, different brands. I think that's how he got his collection.
The team disbanded in 1950. Jim Bunger is now 91, played toward the end of the Flying Dutchman's reign.
And I played with Dutchman 47, 48, 49. I played tackle and guard most of the time, both ways, on defense and offense.
But like many of his teammates, Bunger's had to eventually say goodbye to football.
In 50, I got married. Well, then football was over with for me. Yeah, I couldn't take a chance on getting hurt more or anything after I got married. Oh, I really enjoyed playing the football net, but... it's just after you get married that you don't play that anymore.
Now 81, Jansen hopes to pass along some of the history he remembers so fondly.
Like I said, it was crowds like sometimes 3,000 people at that game because, you know, years ago there was no television, you know, and that's how it was. Everybody went to a game. People followed everything. And now it's hard to get people to get involved, even volunteering, you know. It's keep things going that you used to belong to. I love helping people, and I just This is history that you, people should know.
You gotta be a football hero to get along with the beautiful girls.
This story came from an audience question as part of the Wisconsin Project. Submit your question and we might answer it in a future Wisconsin Life segment. Go to WPR.org/Wisconsin. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Want to make sure you catch every Wisconsin Life story? Subscribe to our podcast, wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Maureen McCollum.
Coming up, Color in the Outdoors is a group working to bring marginalized people into nature. The founder of that organization joins the show coming up next here on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Now, it's National Park Week, and despite some dreary weather today, it's still a good time to celebrate by getting outside. A Wisconsin-based group is focused on getting people in the outdoors, especially encouraging marginalized groups to enjoy the natural spaces around us. The group, called Color in the Outdoors, advocates for diversity, accessibility, and inclusivity, and works toward equitable access in outdoor spaces. That includes a wide range of activities, including hiking, fishing, foraging, and spelunking, among many more. Christopher Kilgore is the founder of Color in the Outdoors and a UW alum. Christopher, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me. I appreciate it.
What did you see out there that made you want to start a group to work on these things?
Well, I guess the easier way to answer that would be what I didn't see. ever since I was a young child, I spent the majority of my time year-round outdoors when at all possible. And grew up in Madison, grew up right in the center of town, and more times than not, the people that I was spending time with and the people I was surrounded by didn't necessarily look like me. And it wasn't necessarily noticeable as a younger child, but as I got older, it definitely was. And so as I was able to be in a position where I could start acting as a mentor or a role model of sorts with some of the younger folks, but also just as a peer with folks my age and some older, I decided it was in my best interest, not only to just be able to have folks to spend time with outdoors, but also to continue that legacy of handing that information and that passion for the outside world down. And as people kind of continue to give me nudges with their elbows saying, you really need to do something more organized. That's how Color in the Outdoors was essentially born.
What are some of the biggest obstacles for people of color to get out and enjoy nature?
Well, I think that there are, you know, the list is long. Unfortunately, I think accessibility is one thing. I think that oftentimes the spaces that we tend to recreate in outdoors are often far away or often kind of sequestered in an area that isn't necessarily accessible. So things like bus lines, things like transportation can provide a barrier. I think another thing is, again, to that point of seeing faces that look like you or seeing people that look like you out on trail. When you're in certain parts of the state, certain parts of the country, certain parts of the city, even oftentimes you don't necessarily see representation on those levels. And so it sometimes can be a bit daunting or intimidating and can therefore create some barrier in and of itself that way. I think that the more we see even things like signage, things like when there's kind of print and with social media being the way that it is in this day and age, the more representation you see in those spaces as well, the more likely people are going to be feeling more comfortable in outdoor spaces.
As you mentioned, Christopher, people elbowed you and tried to get you to do a more organized effort. In turn, how do you encourage other people to get engaged in this effort and stay engaged?
I think one of the biggest things is to just, you know, and it's easier and sometimes said than done, but just really do it. Get outside, grab some friends or family. Figure out what is your comfort zone initially. And one of the things that I think we really need to make a point of saying is outdoor spaces include your front yard. They include going outside the door. And then that is why indeed it is called outdoor space. And I think that to that point, having friends or family, peers, colleagues, coworkers, take a walk in the park, take a walk down the street, observe the outdoor space in a way that you might normally not. We're so plugged into electronics and busy schedules these days that we typically don't literally spend time smelling the roses and seeing the forest for the trees. Then there are also just quite a few organizations, not only locally, but regionally and nationally, that are doing their best to continue to try to offer these opportunities up for folks as well. So, you know, we have these wonderful spaces on the internet where you can Google looking for different affinity groups or different organizations. And there are quite a few out there within the social media realm alone that are definitely offering up some fantastic programming and fantastic times outside and in outdoor spaces with groups and with people that are like you.
Now, suppose somebody's listening who runs a local parks department in a community or maybe a state park or whatever level. How would you suggest they kind of inventory and see what they can do if they're thinking, yeah, this sounds great. I want to make sure my park or parks are accessible to everybody.
Well, I think that, you know, one of the biggest things that I encourage folks that are in charge of spaces like that to do is to do an inventory, and not an inventory by themselves, but an inventory with affinity groups, with focus groups, things like that, where you can say, do you feel welcome in these spaces and what could we do differently or better? I think that to that point, anytime a space says, no, we don't need to do that, chances are they really need to do that. So I think that that's one of those kind of self-check situations where it's important to reach out beyond perhaps your circle or bubble and ask folks how they feel and if they indeed do feel comfortable and welcome. And then if the answer is yes, then what could they do to help encourage others and to get the word out?
We're talking to Christopher Kilgore, founder of Color in the Outdoors, also a UW alum. Christopher, are there, I don't know, wins big or small that you can point to or even in process right now where you think, yes, we've really moved the needle here?
I think, you know, from a more local, Wisconsin, we'll use that as our parameter space. There are a lot of things that on governmental levels, both within city, county, state government, folks are starting to see that this is indeed an important conversation to be having. There are some efforts being made to that point of showing inclusion when you have brochures and print material. When it comes to the, for instance, the Department of Outdoor Recreation has done a wonderful job of putting together a booklet with representation and intentional representation. There are also other organizations and entities that are starting to do the same. So I think to that point of wins, there are individuals, for instance, a friend of mine, James Mills, who is a guest lecturer at the Nelson Institute at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, my alum. I would be remiss if I didn't mention those types of things. But also other organizations. There's an author, Danae O'Dowd, who has written several books with representation of kids of color in the outdoor spaces. There's organizations like Outdoor Afro, Latino Outdoors, et cetera, where we've got, you know, there are more and more organizations and groups doing that and more organizations being brought to the table. And I guess I would say to that point, it's not just having a seat at the table, but it's also having a cup, a plate, a knife, a spoon, and a meal. Not just having a voice, but being actually included in the conversation in a longer term and in a sustainable way.
At the structural level, I know there were points in American history where cities might be building lots of parks and overwhelmingly building them in predominantly white neighborhoods, not so much in predominantly black or Latino neighborhoods. How do you start to tackle a bigger problem that's already built in like that?
Well, one of the things that I, you know, if I were in a perfect world and part of a city planning division, if you will, I would say that not all spaces that are going to be quote unquote renovated, torn down buildings, and not all should be turned into parking lots and high rises. We definitely need more accessible green space. Those green spaces that are within city limits and city parameters, I think it's also extremely important that there's funding and efforts being made to keep those a place that folks want to be and keep those places being a welcoming space, even as something as simple as signage and having signs in languages more than just English. There are a lot of folks from a lot of different walks of life. I think we'd also be remiss if we didn't talk about the you know, acknowledgement of having most of the parks, for instance, in the city of Madison, all the parks in the city of Madison being on Ho-Chunk land and having some sort of nod to and an affirmation and talking about those types of things too.
Christopher, just very briefly, it looks like winter outside, but it is spring in Wisconsin. Springtime, what are you most excited about when it comes to getting outdoors?
Well, you know, with springtime comes flowers, comes the budding of trees. There's lots of foraging to do in certain areas where mushrooms start to pop up and ferns start to come out and that kind of thing. The birds are starting to come back. BIPOC birders of Wisconsin and Color in the Outdoors are going to be doing an event in June, trying to get folks outside with their optics and their eyeballs and trying to find the birds that have decided to come back, including those that have stuck around. So lots of hikes to be had, lots of wonderful things to be done. Fishing season opens first week in May typically, so that's coming up. Just a lot to be done with the weather warming up.
We'll leave it there. Thanks to our guest, Christopher Kilgore, founder of Color in the Outdoors. Tomorrow on Central Time, speaking of birds, we'll visit Wisconsin's bald eagle population. That and more coming up tomorrow on Central Time.